This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
The danger they endured.
They said my head should be cut off.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins. And this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And this was due not so much to scarcity of men as of money. Difficulty of subsistence made the invaders reduce the number of the army to a point at which it might live on the country during the prosecution of the war. Even after the victory they obtained on their arrival, and a victory there must have been, or the fortification of the naval camp could never have been built, there is no indication of their whole force having been employed. On the contrary, they seem to have turned to cultivation of the Chersonese and to piracy from want of supplies. This was what really enabled the Trojans to keep the field for then 10 years against them, the dispersion of the enemy making them always a match for the detachment left behind. In short, if they had stuck to the siege, the capture of Troy would have cost them less time and less trouble. But as want of money proved the weakness of earlier expeditions, so from the same cause, even the one in question, more famous than its predecessors, may be pronounced on the evidence of what it accomplished, to have been inferior to its renown and to the current opinion about it formed under the tuition of the poets. Hi, hello there, welcome. This is Let's Talk About Myths, baby! Or rather, Let's Talk About Myths and How They Interact With History? But that's a little wordy. I'm your host, Liv, here with another episode diving into the Bronze Age, the Mediterranean, and leading up to its momentous collapse. We've already looked at the Bronze Age people of Greece, the Minoans based on Crete and the Mycenaeans on the mainland, and later on the islands, the broader Aegean, if you will. But what about the rest of the Bronze Age Med? Well, today we're going to try our best to touch on the other important cultures of that time, how they interacted with the Greeks, and what marks were left behind in those Homeric epics that I so love to talk about. Like just now at the beginning, that quote I read up top once again was from Thucydides. And again, just this really, perhaps dry sounding, but really interesting look at how an ancient Athenian historian, so many centuries later, tried to reasonably parse out how the Trojan War might have happened. This is episode 258, When History Becomes Mythology, Bronze Age Greece in the Wider Mediterranean. We've talked about the people that we identify with the Greeks during the Bronze Age, again, the Minoans and the Mycenaeans, and how they operated within their own realms. And so far, you know, we've emphasized just how connected they were with the wider Mediterranean, but we need to look at what that wider Mediterranean was. So far, we've only really looked at how the Minoans and the Mycenaeans interacted with each other. And that's where today comes in. The Bronze Age Aegean, that is, the Bronze Age Greeks, we will refer to as the Aegean, was really only a small piece of the wider Bronze Age Mediterranean. When it comes to looking at the Med as a whole at this time, the impact of the people in the Aegean was really quite small. Compared to the other peoples and cultures that existed at this time, the Aegean was like the backwater cousins. We love them, they did amazing cool stuff and are objectively the only reason I have a career, but when compared to the rest of the Mediterranean and the Near East during this time period, oh, they are vastly overshadowed. The Bronze Age Aegean really grew up underneath these other areas and were in contact with them in various ways throughout the entire period, but they never became a big player. They were the younger siblings who came along when the rest were already grown, just trying to catch up to the big kids around them. It's important to remember this, you know, when we consider how these cultures interacted and influenced each other, and how these connections influenced later myths. You know, they did not exist in isolation. They were one piece of the wider puzzle of the time, and their place in it, while very important, was small compared to what the other major players were doing. Now, we do not have time to go into any depth on what the other cultures were at this time and what they were doing, but I will touch on them oh so briefly to give you an overview of the various trade conflicts and contacts that are happening. We've already looked at the Aegean players, the Minoans and the Mycenaeans, but let's look at who was doing what in the wider region. Who were the big players? Because the Greeks were not them. The Hittite Empire thrived during the Bronze Age in Anatolia, Turkey. The Egyptians were, of course, setting themselves up to be famous for millennia. The Canaanites were in the Levant in Palestine and Lebanon. In fact, there's a certain city that's about 5,000 years old. It appears on countless maps of the Bronze Age and its collapse, even if it's only taken 6 months to erase that history with Western bombs. The Cypriots were obviously rocking it on Cyprus. There's an Aphrodite joke in there for anyone who gets it. The Mitanni people ruled over much of what's now Iraq, Turkey, Syria, and then the other most famous, the Assyrians and the Babylonians, collectively the Mesopotamians of ancient Iraq. They weren't actually on the Mediterranean, but they do count all the same. All these people and empires were vastly connected to each other through trade and elite networks. Conflicts between one another and, of course, through the people who were moving around the Med for all the various reasons, just like people do today. We will spend more time with some ancient groups than others, but I will be touching on each one briefly. And we're going to take a special interest in the Hittites because of a little mythical but historically inspired thing called the Trojan War. It's important to remember, though, when going through each one of these ancient groups, that all of these people were coexisting and interacting amongst each other in significantly more complicated ways than I could possibly communicate to you in one episode. I have to be brief in order to relay information, but the reality of the time is that these cultures were vast and complicated and deserve so much more time to really appreciate all that was happening. We are talking centuries, sometimes millennia worth of history, squished into one podcast episode. This won't be thorough, but I hope it will give you just a little idea of what was happening and maybe inspire you to learn more on your own. Gods know there's more to learn. Of course, not every one of these people had the same level of ties with the people of the Aegean. Given the nature of trade during this time, Aegean wares were being spread vastly through the ancient Mediterranean and Near East because of these networks, but the people themselves weren't necessarily making it that far. The people of ancient Iraq and Iran are not particularly closely connected to the Aegean, as much as some of the others are. Not unconnected, but they are not close. The peoples who were living in the region of ancient Iraq and some of Iran were broadly the Assyrians, Babylonians, and a bit northern into the eastern part of Turkey, the Mitanni. This is the area where people like Enheduanna and Hammurabi come from, the Epic of Gilgamesh too, but at vastly different time periods, because the span of ancient history in Iraq is unbelievable. It is a place with thousands and thousands and thousands of years of history. All three of these kingdoms existed for just these vast spans of time and played off each other in trade, conflict, and connection throughout this whole time. They are like many thousands of years older than the Mycenaeans, even the Minoans. And there are more, too, that make up this group that we call the Mesopotamians, all from ancient Iraq. But we are remaining brief. Their borders also vastly changed and altered throughout history, and their connections with the other kingdoms, you know, were also present. Mitanni and Egypt often had conflicts with each other, but Egypt was also connected with various Babylonian and Assyrian kings that we can see from these letters called the Amarna letters, which we will return to. But for now, there were things happening in this region that were just so complicated and so vast that, frankly, we cannot dive into anything, especially because it does not connect with the Aegean focus as much as I would love to cover the whole of this ancient history. The important thing is that this was a highly developed area, and its connections mainly come from the abundance of tin in the region. That's right, an ever-important metal in the making of bronze, which is a thing I just learned because Michaela wrote it into a script. Thank you, Michaela. Just as I am not a farmer, I am also not a metalworker. The Canaanites and the Cypriots are similarly not our biggest focus, yet important to understand the level of complexity and connection during this time. The Canaanites they're sort of a general term we use to describe many different peoples, kind of like Mesopotamians. Essentially, it's many different people that were living in the southern Levant during the Bronze Age. There were various kingdom states that were connected to others in the area through vassal relationships, mainly with Egypt, because it was the next one over. The Cypriots, on the other hand, were the people living on and from the island of Cyprus, off the Levant. Cyprus was an extremely important island, not only for its strategic position, but also for the wealth of copper that was found on the island. Cyprus is so well known for its copper throughout history that the word copper comes from Cyprus. Specifically, Ace Cyprium in Latin, or the metal of Cyprus. And guess what you need for bronze? That's right, copper. So now we know where the two major pieces of the bronze puzzle were found. And I know what you need to make bronze. Tin was found primarily in this region of ancient Iraq and Iran, and then copper from Cyprus. And not only was Cyprus famous for its copper, but it also had a vast amount of timber. We're using the word vast a lot today. It's just very relevant. Timber in ancient history was hugely important, like it is today, especially considering they had to make their ships somehow. So Cyprus, incredibly important for resources like copper and timber, as well as for trade within the Mediterranean. You know, it's this big island kind of centrally in the southeast. Lots happening there. Similar to Crete in that way, just in a very different spot. And the Cypriots really took their role as traders to heart. There's evidence for Cypriots moving and existing all throughout the Mediterranean and the Near East. In fact, it's very likely that there was a group of Cypriots living in Tiryns on the Peloponnesian Peninsula of Greece during the late 13th century, which is just alongside the Mycenaeans and goes to show just the extent of their reach in these trade networks. Considering that the majority of copper that was used was Cypriot in origin, this makes sense, as you would expect the people who originated from that island to take an interest in bringing these wares around the Mediterranean. And Cypriot wares are found pretty much everywhere in the Bronze Age. They got around. Further connections with the Aegean appears in the use of Cypro-Minoan script, this writing system that has yet to be deciphered, but the syllabary that's used is so similar to Linear A that this connection between Cyprus and Minoan Crete is made. And this script appears not only on Cyprus, but is also found in various coastal sites around the Mediterranean. And for even further Aegean connections, we have the vast amount of Mycenaean pottery found on the island. Now granted, look, Mycenaean pottery is found all over the place along the Mediterranean, as you heard last week, it made it all the way to Portugal. And not because, you know, it was particularly astounding or anything. I mean, I'm sure it's someone's favorite. But most likely because the goods found within it were what was more highly valued. Olive oil, wine, perfumes, etc. But because those things were so sought after, then the pottery remains as far as those items traveled. It's just, what a joy. Archaeology is a joy. And so, you know, just the existence of that pottery shows us the extent of trading that the Mycenaeans and the Cypriots were collectively involved with.
When the Taliban banned music in Afghanistan, millions were plunged into silence. Radios were smashed, cassettes burned. You could be beaten or jailed or killed for breaking the rules. And yet, Afghans did it anyway. This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The danger they endured.
They said, my head should be cut off.
The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season 1, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season 1, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turned sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And now, with that brief look at some of the other major players in the Mediterranean at this time, we are left with the two that we are going to focus on the most, the Hittites and the Egyptians. I'm sure everyone is at least somewhat familiar with the Egyptians and the extent of their power throughout not only the Bronze Age, but into the Iron Age and beyond. I mean, they're the ancient Egyptians. They are an old power, one whose history is so long that it's almost incomprehensible, and there's no way that we can cover even like a tiny bit of how deep it goes. But we also can't ignore them, because they were a major player, and because, I mean, I have seen the cinematic artistry that is 1999's The Mummy. I know what happens when you forget your manners with the ancient Egyptians, and I will not be falling for that trap. So back in the Iron Age was really the height of Egyptian culture as we know it. You know, it's not the Egypt of Cleopatra and the Ptolemies. It is not the Egypt that was taken over by Alexander or the one that was fighting Rome. This is long, long, long before any of that, a millennia before any of that. This Egypt was an empire that was so powerful, they were able to flip the rules of elite relations to make it most advantageous to themselves and that something that no one else could push up against. In the elite circles of the Bronze Age, royal marriages between kingdoms were common to ensure relations between these leading powers. All these kingdoms would marry their daughters to each other to secure relationships through those marriages. But Egypt wouldn't marry their daughters out to any other kingdom. This way, there would be no possible heirs born in neighboring kingdoms who could then vie for a pharaonic position. They instead chose to only allow others to marry into the Egyptian royal family. Because they got to make the rules. And this seemed to be a pretty steadfast rule during the Bronze Age, and it worked for them. There are instances, though, where things get a little more loosey-goosey when times aren't going so well. But broadly, I mean, the Egyptians were the Egyptians. But what makes Egypt such an important and key place for our purposes? I mean, what doesn't? The Nile was incredibly fertile and made growing certain key grain crops super easy. Not only did they have all of this wonderful grain that feeds the masses, but they also had access to many different precious metals like gold. You gotta love gold. People love gold. They do a lot for gold. And honestly, gold can do a lot for them. From an economical standpoint, at the very least, gold, important. It has always been the case. Super shiny, thus super important. I've never totally understood it. So Egypt was just one of those places that was very productive and capable of sustaining quite the empire. And it did exactly that. They also, though, and this is what's most important for us, they enjoyed recording things. They liked it quite a bit, and so we have lots of textual evidence for the goings-on. We have the Egyptians to thank for so much knowledge of the wider Bronze Age Mediterranean, simply because they, like, had a thing for journaling. You know, what we don't find, though, in these deep and extensive records that the Egyptians left behind and that tell us so much about these most ancient cultures that didn't leave us written record? You know what we don't find in any of that? Any tiny hint that Atlantis was ever anything outside of Plato's imagination. That's right. What we do have are things like the Aegean list from Amenhotep's III's mortuary temple, which gives us a list of places that were known to the Egyptians of the early 14th century. Key dates here. These statues didn't just have the Aegean place names, but pretty much everywhere that was known to the Egyptians at the time, which is amazing. But we are concerned with the Aegean and its connections largely. So when places like Mykenae, Knossos, and Kythera, among others, appear on these lists, we get excited. Because not only are we seeing Aegean sites on this Bronze Age Egyptian list, but we're also seeing names for the Minoans and the Mycenaeans from that time. We saw one of these names in the Minoan episode, Keftiu, but we also get one that heads the list of Mycenaean sites, Tanaya. It's not just names, but people too that appear in Egypt. Evidence that people we think are the Minoans were depicted in Egyptian art, and even the Minoan style art is found in Egypt. The Mycenaeans are not so clearly represented in Egypt, but we know that they were known, not least from the above-mentioned Aegean list, which also makes sense because Crete was just so much closer to Egypt. And then we have the wonderful Amarna letters that I mentioned up earlier. This is less to do with the Aegean, but really demonstrates the kinds of connections between elites during the Bronze Age and how they related to each other. These tablets were found in the Egyptian city of Amarna, where Akhenaten, who gained power after his father, Amenhotep III, died. He moved the capital there. These letters were found in a records room. I mean, that's what we call it, because we found them there. Who knows? But they were written in Akkadian, which appears to be the common tongue for a sort of international correspondence between rulers, and then gives us a host of information on how the elites related and talked to each other. And as we will see, and have already been hinted at, the collapse of the Bronze Age is a collapse of the elite power structure. And so through these letters, we get a sense of how the elites worked with one another. Lots of it is set in a way that establishes them as both family and equals. Like, power is communicated through familial relationships, where one person might refer to another king as father to show that they're not of equal standing. Like, are these people actually related to each other in any manner? Probably not. But there is this, like, familial shadow cast on their relationships that, like, binds all these elites of the cultures of the time, like, together? It's really interesting. But the Aegean doesn't show up in these letters. And so from this, we can kind of emphasize and understand that the Aegean and the elites of that region were just not at the same social standings that the other elites were. You know, they were not elites from Egypt. They were not elites from Babylon. They were a little closer to peasants by comparison. Elite for Mycenaean, yes. Not for Egyptian. And so again, this goes back to this understanding that as much as we love the Minoans and Mycenaeans, in the grand scheme of the ancient Mediterranean, they were just not on the same level. And who knows what could have happened over time? Like, maybe they would have eventually gotten to a similar standing if the whole thing hadn't collapsed. So that's the Egyptians, but what about those Hittites? You may be asking. I mean, if you're not asking, you should. The Hittites are important. This is big. We're finally getting to Troy. As you might expect, the Hittites are vastly important to understanding the Bronze Age and were a huge presence on the land itself. But they were largely forgotten about for most of history. Like, it wasn't until the early 1800s when archaeologists were working on Roman sites in what is now Turkey, and they realized they were looking at something that was much, much older than the Romans. Like, significantly older. Like, there was no chance in the world it could be the Romans. Some archaeologists and academics at the time speculated that what they were looking at was Egyptian, but this idea was quickly thrown away. Like, obviously what was being seen was just something else, something different, something that they hadn't known about before. And so piecing out the Hittites is still not the easiest thing in the world. The name Hittite even was chosen from biblical accounts, but that's not what these people called themselves. I don't really have a lot of time for anything that comes from biblical accounts, but here we are. They reference themselves, not as Hittites, but as the Neshians or the Neshites, named for the city that was their capital for 200 years. And they were an old people, with evidence of them existing in that region in various ways from the very beginning of the Bronze Age all the way to its collapse. In fact, the Hittites were arguably one of the bigger empires in the Bronze Age, like easily going up against the Egyptians, Mitanni, Assyrians, and Babylonians. Just like Egypt, they even controlled many different vassal states in the region, and the power that they exerted was felt across the region. The capital was eventually moved to a site called Hattusa by a king named Hattusili. His name literally means like the man of Hattusa, which is delightful. This change of capital was pivotal, as the new site was heavily fortified, not only by the built environment, but also by geography. And at this site, what have we found? Clay tablets. We love clay tablets. We love textual sourcing. And clay tablets tends to be one of the only ways it survives that much time. Now, unfortunately, not all of these tablets are readable to us. The writing that is found on them, while written in a familiar cuneiform, is not a language that has been deciphered quite yet. Still, it shows us the use of a language that was their own, like they weren't relying on others. Other tablets were written in Akkadian and tell us so much more information about just life there. Not just administrative, but religious documents, poems and stories and histories. These tablets have allowed us to piece together the puzzle of the Hittite Empire and just how grand it really was. And these people were seriously powerful. They were able to march on Babylon and burn it to the ground and end Hammurabi's dynasty. Though they went home immediately after, as is their right. I kind of respect it. That was very early, though. It's the Hittite Empire of the late Bronze Age that is of interest to us, because these are the people who had direct contact and conflict with the Aegean Greeks of the time. It is from these conflicts that the story of the Trojan War comes. Just a little seed of the Trojan War, I should say, is in these conflicts. It was inspired by them in some form. We shouldn't believe there was anything ever quite like the Trojan War, but instead evidence of multiple conflicts between the groups and remnants of which eventually inspired the epic poems. The history of contact and conflict between the Mycenaean states of the mainland and the Hittites is a long one. Starting around 1430 BCE, the Hittites were dealing with various revolutions and conflicts with the states in their region, collectively known as Asuwa. These states in Asuwa were generally located in northwestern Turkey, and one of the names that we encounter in this region controlled by the Hittites is Willusia. Now, if you're especially nerdy, you might already recognize this name, but if you're not, don't worry, we'll get there. The early word for the city of Troy, the earliest Greek word, and how we get the name of the Iliad, is Ilion. And now, just a real quick ancient Greek lesson, the Greek alphabet is made up of 24 characters, and this has been true since pretty much the classical period. But there's a hell of a lot of time before the classical period. There is an earlier letter that was just sort of phased out over time. You'll hear classicists talk about it. I don't totally understand what's going on with it, but I enjoy speculating based on what I hear. For our purposes, all we need to know is that it was called a digamma, and it made a kind of W sound. I don't know why it went out of use. It's just one of those peculiarities of languages that just happen through time. But this does mean that there are some words in the Mycenaean period that had this W sound at the beginning, and then that was lost into the later Greek that we now have. Like, the Mycenaean word for king is wanax. It's this perfect example, because in Linear B, it's wanax, and it later becomes simply anax, just because this digamma falls away. And this is true for Ilion, which in earlier Mycenaean Greek would have been something more like Willion. Which, yes, let's all be excited about this, because it is truly exciting. It sounds a lot. Enough, I would argue, like Willusia, because, like, it is. Like, it's that. We can go with this thread. And my episode with Eric Klein coming up next week on The Collapse is going to have more of these examples that, like, blew my mind in the moment. But at least for now, we have some historical presence for the city of Troy in this region. Which brings me back to the idea of these vassal kingdoms. Remember how I just mentioned this? Well, we can see that, like, while the city of Troy was geographically close to the Hittite Empire, it has a history of not being specifically part of it. Like, it was its own thing, operating how it chose to, but it would often have very close ties to the Hittites themselves. But what's really exciting about this specific revolution is that we found a sword with an inscription on it. And the inscription reads, "As Duthalia, the great king, shattered the Asua country, he dedicated these swords to the storm god he loved." Now, this inscription directly ties the swords to this conflict that happened with the Asua region. And when the sword was examined further, it was identified as being of Mycenaean make. Now, why would a Mycenaean sword with this inscription on it be found deep in this Hittite kingdom? Not totally clear, but at the very least, it shows us that the Hittites and the Mycenaeans were in contact with each other. Were maybe the Mycenaeans mercenaries of the Hittites, or maybe they also for a time operated as one of these vassal states to this big Hittite empire? We don't know, but regardless, we have the Hittites and the Mycenaeans seemingly together in a conflict with this region of Asua, where the city of Willusia is located. Yeah, that's why we think the Trojan War isn't real. It's just inspired by lots of wild stuff put together. Now, the date of this particular conflict was, like, much too early for the agreed upon date of the Trojan War. But that's because that's nonsense anyway. But what we do get is an establishment of conflicts between the mainland Greeks and the people living in the Troad. So very likely we have the inspiration for what the poets would later go on to create as the Trojan War, and which at some point or another got a date assigned to it that just was not quite right for the actual date of the conflict. But we can't blame them for that, because as you're about to see, the whole thing's going to collapse. And so here we stay in ancient Ilion, Troy, before this collapse, and what the actual archaeological site of Troy can tell us about the connections between Troy and mainland Greece. Throughout history, Troy as a site has always been incredibly popular. Many people throughout time have visited the site for their own personal reasons, but also to interact with this narrative around the Trojan cycle. Especially, you know, in more recent centuries, this idea of the Homeric tradition as, like, humanity's origins was very popular amongst rich elite people of Europe. You know, I'm not gonna directly say it has problematic origins, but, like, you can make the assumption. But it leads us to, so as archaeology as a field was really new, really just starting to develop, the discovery of Troy and hopeful proof of where this great war occurred was quite high on many people's lists because of this great mentality surrounding the Iliad. The man who got to it first was Heinrich Schliemann. There's no way I haven't mentioned Schliemann before now. He's a really famous troublemaker when talking about the Bronze Age. He fucked a lot of shit up. Schliemann was around in the 19th century, to put it into our time frame, so he's pretty recent. He wasn't a trained archaeologist like we think of them now. This was an earlier time, and so he was really just an eccentric German businessman who had what all archaeologists really dream of having: money. But he also had an obsession with the Iliad, with Troy. This money allowed him to self-fund the digs that he wanted to happen, and he wanted to prove the Trojan War was real. And so this is how he got his hands on two very important archaeological sites. Troy and Mycenae. Because, yeah, he had a real hard-on for finding proof of the Trojan War and all those Achaean heroes. He's also why the very pretty gold mask found in a tomb of Mycenae is called the Mask of Agamemnon. Because he found a mask with a man's face on it, and it was gold. And so he said, huzzah, this is obviously Agamemnon. Anyway, it's not. But it's a nice mask. This gives you a little insight into his archaeological prowess, shall we say. Now, Schliemann did not get his hands on Knossos, which I want to say was nice, but instead it was Arthur Evans who turned it into a questionable recreation that is kind of a bummer. But Schliemann didn't do a lot better with Mycenae and Troy. His methods were questionable at best. Like, he dynamited his way through the exact level where the Trojan War, like, would have been. Because he believed that the deepest level of the city had to be the level of the Trojan War. For, like, no other reason other than, I think, probably he thought that meant it would be the greatest. Like, the oldest is the greatest. I don't know. But he destroyed a lot. Because Troy has existed for so long and was built over so many kind of destroyed cities for various reasons, we refer to each layer as, like, Troy 6. That's going to come up soon. But that refers to the level of the earth where these certain things were found. I'm not going to go into more science. You get it. But honestly, when it comes to Schliemann, like, I cannot with this man. Like, if you feel like hating him for a reason other than dynamiting Troy or assuming everything that he found proved the existence of Agamemnon of all people, then let me just also share a little bit about his personal life. Like, maybe you think I'm being too harsh, okay? Okay. So basically, Heinrich Schliemann, when he was just this rich businessman before he devoted his life to finding Troy, he wanted to legally opt out of his marriage and his wife and three children. And she wouldn't divorce him. So he left his family to move from Europe to Indiana because Indiana had lax divorce laws. And so by living in Indiana for a few months, because he had all the money in the world, he was able to force his wife to divorce him. And then he immediately moved to Athens, where 2 months later, he married a 17-year-old Greek girl. I think he would have been about 45 and had three kids. I don't know how old they were, but this girl was 17. Oh, and he procured this new wife. I don't even know what to do with this. Because his friend, I want to say found her, but really no, she was his cousin. Because Schliemann went to Athens and chatted with his friend who was also an archbishop. And he was like, I just want to find someone who, and this is a quote from Wikipedia, someone who is enthusiastic about Homer and about a rebirth of my beloved Greece, with a Greek name and a soul impassioned for learning. So when somebody showed him a 17-year-old girl named Sophia, he was sold. Anyway, Sophia just means wisdom in Greek. And I'm going to stop now, except to say that they had two children, and their names were Agamemnon and Andromache. I mean, if I think I'm obsessed, I would never. My God, man. This man was a horror show, but again, he found Troy and Mycenae. Like, he didn't do it well, and other people probably would have done it better just, like, a little bit later if he hadn't. But I suppose we do still have to credit him and his pervy money with the finds. Now, he started the excavations at Troy, but obviously there have been many excavations since, so we can set Schliemann aside in the backwaters of history where he belongs. And tell you that what we now have, thanks to actual archaeologists, is a pretty detailed understanding of the various levels of settlement that happened at the site. Not as detailed as we would like, but you know, sometimes dynamite causes some damage. There are 9 different levels of settlement at Troy that range from 3000 BCE to 950 BCE. The level that we are most interested in is this sixth layer, Troy 6, which ranges from around circa 1750 to 1300. And so if there was only one conflict that inspired the story of the Trojan War, it's believed to have taken place during 1250 BCE. This is hotly debated. It's also possible there were lots of conflicts. At least one conflict, if not multiple, eventually inspired the Iliad. But again, you know, however sad this may be, we should not believe anything from the Iliad actually happened, even setting aside the very likely detail of a man fighting a river. It is fiction. The exact nature of this war, the real war, is unclear, and likely we won't ever be able to discern, like, what it was about. Nor are we ever able to, like, completely decide what caused the destruction of that sixth level of Troy. As I mentioned, there definitely was conflict between the Mycenaeans and the city of Troy, but whether this was directly between each other or the Mycenaeans being used by the Hittite Empire, totally unclear. If there's one thing we can be clear about, though, is that the war was not started because of a pretty woman. Helen is not at fault, nor was she at fault in the Iliad, for that matter. Still, looking at Troy 6, this level most likely to align with a war that could have inspired later epics, we are able to tell that the city was incredibly important and wealthy. The region itself is incredibly advantageous, as it's so close to the Bosphorus Strait, which connects the wider Mediterranean to the Black Sea, good old Hellespont. In the layer of Troy 6, too, we find many examples of pottery and goods from not only mainland Greece, but also Minoan and Cypriot, Levantine, Mesopotamian, Egyptian, like, everything. It was a hugely connected area, as I've said 1,000 times, but specifically the architecture itself also shows influence from the Hittites and Mycenaeans. The city itself was also heavily fortified with walls and towers that looked out over the surrounding landscape, which itself was filled with habitation. The area was extensively developed and not a small little city-state. Like, the city itself was filled with various buildings, some that even resembled the Megaron houses that we see on mainland Greece. But this city level was eventually destroyed by something. Some speculate that the destruction was not caused by people, but earthquakes. Regardless of the reason, it was eventually rebuilt, and rather quickly, actually. This is just not a site that was ever inactive for very long. And just to really drill in the Homeric inspiration found here, there are some tablets found at Hattusa that have some names of people and places that might sound familiar. For instance, Achiawa and Alexandru. Basically, Achaeans and Alexandros, which is another name for Paris. And finally, it comes in handy that I no longer seem to be able to pronounce Achaea with my regular accent. Achaea. Anyway, Achaea sounds a lot more like Achiawa. You're welcome. These names, they don't confirm anything, but they do give us just these little hints about how the later epic poets might have found little bits and pieces of inspiration in what was left behind by the Bronze Age people that had come before them. They didn't have the answers. They didn't have a book to read. They just had all of these little things left behind and the stories that they could come up with surrounding those little things. Oh, nerds, as always, thank you so much for listening. This has been a wild ride, traveling across the Bronze Age Mediterranean. And we're not done yet. On Friday, I have a conversation with the wonderful Joel Christensen, who is back to talk about Homeric epic, but particularly how the stories began and how they were transmitted and what we know about when they became the Iliad and the Odyssey that survive today. We might not ever be able to make direct connections between this Bronze Age history and the creation of the epics, but I don't think this series would be complete without a little deviation into the Iron Age to look at the epics that were certainly somehow inspired by this Bronze Age of Greece. Once again, this episode is more than long enough, so I will just leave you with a 5-star review from one of you amazing listeners. And boy, does this one have a great pun in it. Thank you. This comes from a user called Kitman Forbesy from the UK. Let's talk about myths, baby. Just discovered this very informative, sassy, dynamic podcast. A joy to listen to and to increase understanding of all things Greek. Euripides these reviews up, baby. Just brilliant. Thank you. I mean, did it roll off the tongue? No. Was it a Euripides pun? Yes. That's all that matters. So thank you for that review. And on everyone else, if you haven't left one, consider heading over to Apple Podcasts to say something nice about me. It makes me happy. Like, it helps the show keep going and, like, existing in your ears. But also indirectly does that by making me happy, and I could really use more happy. This goes for any and all appreciation of the show. I'm having a rough go of it right now. The fact that this sounded normal is impressive. It says I've gotten really good at reading into a microphone without crying. So if you feel like telling me why this wild thing I do every week is benefiting you in some way and is worthwhile, please feel free to reach out on social media or email. I'm smithsbaby@gmail.com or honestly wherever. I can't promise I will reply, but you will know that you made me feel better, so thanks. Let's talk about Miss Baby. It's written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Michaela Smith is the Hermes to my Olympians. I mean, she's the assistant producer, but, like, in this series, I mean, God, it wouldn't exist without her for multiple reasons, but, like, as you heard in that script, like, I didn't know the thing about copper or tin. I don't like metallurgy, you know? So without Michaela, I mean, honestly, she wrote this entire script, so thank you, Michaela, you're an actual dream. Laura Smith is the production assistant and audio engineer and is killing it on all of these conversation episodes and putting together a website that is, like, more useful. More news on that soon. Select music in this episode was by Luke Chaos. The podcast is part of the iHeart Podcast Network. Listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Help me continue bringing you the world of Greek mythology and the ancient Mediterranean by becoming a patron, where you'll get past bonus episodes, hopefully new, more ones. I can't speak anymore. Visit patreon.com/mythsbaby or click the link in this episode's description. Back soon with more Bronze Age. What a thrill ride. Cannot wait for the elites to fall. I am Liv and I love this shit. I'll love it more when we defeat capitalism.
This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
The danger they endured.
They said my head should be cut off.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins. And this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.